Oh, well, hey everyone, it's Nate, and I'm here with a bit of an impromptu podcast episode. I got some news to share with you today. It's a bit sad. It's not lost on me that today is Record Store Day, April 20th. So a lot of you have been running around independent record shops and grabbing some good loot. Just also want to share the news with you today about Michael Kaskuna. Michael Kaskuna, who you may know as a jazz historian, pioneer of archiving recorded music and reissuing some very important jazz recordings. Michael passed away. Not sure of the circumstances. He was 75 years old. Not sure exactly when that was, but the news was shared today about that. And I was fortunate enough to have Michael on the show in June of 2019. So I'm going to replay that interview today. Michael, just the headlines, he started his career at Atlantic Records. He was working directly for the Ertegun Brothers, where he then went on to Blue Note and helped not only revive their tape archive and reissued some phenomenally important recordings, but Michael also preserved the Francis Wolfe photography negatives, which is a crucial element of the packaging and the imagery of Blue Note and jazz in general. Michael eventually founded Mosaic Records, and many of you have probably seen those boxes if you don't already own them. Most jazz fans and audiophile completists really consider Mosaic Records a high watermark in making lost recordings available for enjoyment. Michael's impact on the recording and jazz industry is absolutely huge, cannot be overstated. Michael was an absolute visionary, and as music fans and record collectors, we are all better for his time and work. So again, this interview was from June of 2019. Michael graciously shares his history and provided many details and anecdotes for his time in tape vaults and pressing records. So please enjoy this interview replay. And Michael, thank you for everything you did. Godspeed on your journey, mate.
All right, today on The Vinyl Guide, we have on the show jazz enthusiast, founder of Mosaic Records, and a man we all owe a debt of gratitude to for making such wonderful music available, Mr. Michael Kaskuna. Michael, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you, man. Great introduction.
I hope you have a cup of coffee or tea or something because, man, we are going to talk jazz records for the next hour or so.
Okay. I don't have coffee and I don't have tea, but I'm amped up.
Okay, fair enough. Now, Michael, you've had an amazing career. Before you started Mosaic, before you worked on Blue Note, you were a DJ at WPLJ. You used to see many jazz legends live. And in fact, your experiences seeing artists like Coltrane and Monk live, that would be a conversation in itself. But since we only have an hour, let's jump into the thick of it. Your record production and reissue career started at Atlantic Records, yeah?
Well, not really. It actually started earlier. Hmm. When I went to college in 1966, I had in the back of my mind that I wanted to produce records. And so I started doing college radio at WXPN in Philadelphia and ended up on WMMR, the Metro Media station there, doing underground rock. But it was always producing records that was on my mind. And I lived a block away from Dick Waterman, who was a manager who handled Sun House and Fred McDowell and Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and a bunch of people. And so I got to be good friends with Buddy Guy, and I wrote a feature article on him in Downbeat. And he used to come up on my Saturday afternoon show with an acoustic guitar and just play and sing. So we became good friends, and he knew I wanted to get into record production. So he was doing his last album for Vanguard and said, you know, you want to produce it with me? Because I don't like any of the people at Vanguard. So I said, my God, yeah, sure. I gave up Rolling Stones tickets to do this. So that shows you how intent I was. But and then on top of that, Vanguard would not give him a plane ticket to come back and mix the record with me in New York. So I called Blue Thumb Records and I said, would you like to have a Buddy Guy record that's all acoustic? Because I was thinking my radio program. And it could be with a reunion with Junior Wells and a friend of mine, Junior Mance, on piano. And we could call it Buddy and the Juniors. And they grabbed at it. So that became the second record I produced. And then eventually I started producing a singer-songwriter named Chris Smither, who's still active today. And that led to doing a Bonnie Raitt record. And then in 1972, I guess, I went with Atlantic Records as a staff producer. And that's where I got my real education.
Oh, okay. So you built up this this resume of activity prior, and Atlantic Records had heard of you, got familiar with your work, and then offered you a job as a staff producer, I imagine.
Right.
What were the projects that you worked on at Atlantic?
Well, at first, what I worked on was cleanup projects. Like there was a Carmen McRae record that was produced live at some club in California, and it eventually came out as the Great American Songbook. So they said, "Here's the 8-track tapes. Pick the takes, mix it, and sequence it into 2 LPs." So I did stuff like that. Based on my own, then I was assigned to do Dave Brubeck and Oscar Brown Jr. And then I eventually got to be able to sign people. And I signed the Art Ensemble of Chicago and Garland Jeffries, who is a wonderful singer-songwriter who's still around, and Eric Kaz, another singer-songwriter. So, it was, a diverse roster, but I was, learning all the way through.
Okay, so you're a producer and A&R, it sounds like. Was that a natural kind of progression, an amalgamation of those roles in the day?
Yeah, it was for everybody except Arif Martin, who was one of the greatest producers and couldn't sign a talented act to save his life. So it was always somebody signed the act and they gave it to him and he turned it into magic. But basically most producers were A&R men, and a lot of A&R men were also producers.
As I understand the story, when you got to Atlantic, you started doing the roles, and you started getting involved in the material in the Atlantic vaults. What were the Atlantic vaults like during the day? And I always say vault, but I know it's probably just an office room just stuffed with tapes and stuff.
It was actually a warehouse. I forget where it was originally, but you go through the files and you see what was recorded, and I started to notice that there was a lot of extra material from Charles Mingus Records and from Lenny Tristano Records and so on and so forth. So, I started to call up a lot of the material, and I created like I forget how many LPs it was. I guess it might have been 16 or 18 LPs, a complete Ray Charles, which had some unissued material on it. But at that point, Atlantic didn't want to release anything like that. It was, we were getting into the mid-60s, and archival stuff didn't mean that much. So I was able to dig out a bunch of unissued Chick Corea material that Chick told me about, and put that out as a double record with the issued material. But I had meant to go through a lot of other material, Warren Marsh and Mingus and on, but I didn't get to it at the time. And then I struck off and went freelance. And the only other thing I did with the Blue Note Vaults was find the Charles Mingus Antibes 64 tapes with Eric Dolphy and, I mean, not 64, with 62, with Eric Dolphy and Booker Irvin and Bud Powell. And that came out as a double record. And my impetus for that actually was, I was in Europe at one point, I was in France, and I saw a Mingus bootleg of Mingus at Antibes that same year. And I bought it with a guilty conscience, and later discovered that Nesway Erdogan had recorded that multi-track for Atlantic. So I said to Nesway, the only way to fight a bootleg is to put out a legitimate issue and pay the royalties and pay the musicians. So, that's what we did. That was like, it had to come out anyway. It was an important chunk of music, but the intent behind it was to fight bootlegs with legal releases.
Okay, that makes sense. So let me just kind of set the stage here. This is mid-70s at Atlantic. You're going into their archive. You see all this material logged, and you're listening to the tapes. Mainly, is it personal, just for your personal use, your personal curiosity at first?
It was my personal curiosity, definitely. But then I hoped that I could get them to put this stuff out because, you know, if music is unreleased, it doesn't exist. Once you put it out, it does exist, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like the old, you know, if a tree fell in the forest routine.
How difficult was it to convince the Erdogans to release some of this stuff?
Very. I got very little of it out, to which, you know, I have great regrets. Because, you know, unbeknownst to anybody in 1979, they moved all of the Atlantic vaults from 1948 to 1970. All those tapes went to this warehouse in southern New Jersey, which was owned by the brother-in-law of one of the people in finance at Atlantic, who wanted to help his brother-in-law out. Only it was not a qualified warehouse because it was not fireproof and didn't have sprinkler systems.
I hate where this story's going, Michael.
Yeah, and that's exactly where it went. It went up in ashes. And so a lot, almost all of the unissued material from the beginning to 1980, with very few exceptions of stuff that happened to be sitting at this studio in New York, everything went up in smoke. So there's, you know, there's tons of Coltrane and Ornette and Warren Marsh and Lee Konitz that's just gone forever. You know?
Oh, my goodness. Do you remember any of the specific titles that are no longer with us?
No, I spent a couple of decades blocking them out, so I would be frustrated. You know?
Fair enough. So how did you step from Atlantic into working with Blue Note? Was that a direct line, or were there a few twists?
No. Well, you know, when I was producing jazz records for Atlantic and for other people, I would often overhear musicians talking to each other during breaks about, you know, do you remember that Lee Morgan record we did with yada, yada, and yada? That never came out, did it? No, I don't think it did. So I started, because I was a Blue Note addict from the time I was 13 years old, I started a notebook of musicians' recollections of Blue Note sessions that had not come out. And I realized that I was just hearing the tip of the iceberg, that there must be a mother lode in there. And so I kept banging on Blue Note's door to let me get in and let me, you know, just let me research and do the detective work and do the listening and start to put together some of this stuff to put out, because, you know, Lee Morgan was dead at that point. Grant Green was in retirement at that point. And, you know, there was just so many other important artists. Hank Mobley wasn't playing anymore. So I got nowhere for about 2 years. And I finally, at a Donald Byrd party on Central Park South, I met Charlie Lorre, who had just joined Blue Note as, you know, marketing and merchandise director. And he was, you know, he was a musician, a multi-reed player, and who had gotten into the record business at Columbia and then went over to Blue Note when the job was offered, because he was such a Blue Note fan. So I said, let's get together for breakfast tomorrow. And I showed him my notebook, and he said, oh shit, let me talk to some people, but I think you got a gig. So a month later, I was going out to master a Chico Hamilton album that I had produced for Blue Note. And Charlie said, you got a deal, you know, go in and have fun, you know. So I said, oh, great. So that was when I first went into the Blue Note vaults. And it was, you know, it was like an unending job that is going on until recently. But but it was a fairly depressing first day, because I was guided to this room that was, I don't know, about 100 feet by 30 feet with metal shelving and stacks of tape on every shelf, you know, by artist. And, you know, you'd look, you know, it's Jackie McLean, April 24th, 1964, Reel 1, Reel 2, Reel 3, Reel 4. No personnel, no tune titles, no takes chosen, nothing, no documentation at all. So I began a long, slow process of listening to these things, making cassettes of what I thought the best takes were, and sending them, like, I'd send it to Jackie McLean, and then my friend Don Sickler taught me, another way to figure things out is to go to BMI and see what tunes Blue Note registered in its publishing company around the time of the date. So I remember one Jackie McLean date, and I saw there was a couple of Charles Tolliver tunes, and I think there might have been a Jack DeJohnette tune. So I sent Jack and Charles cassettes of the session too. And so everybody was able to identify everybody and identify the tunes. But it was piecemeal and it was hard work. And then finally, about 2 years later, somebody from Japan finds me and contacts me with a file, a Xerox file, of all of Alfred Lion's notes for all the unissued material that was sitting in the cans. And I thought, thank God, you know.
How did those notes make it to Japan? And they
weren't
with the archive?
I guess because, you know, Blue Note was licensed by this company in Japan, King Records. Mm-hmm. And I guess someone at Blue Note in the early 70s knew where this stuff was, and so they Xeroxed it and sent it to them. But, you know, it's like every other company that, the ebb and flow of people is so constant that there's no institutional memory left at most of these companies. Mm-hmm. And so a lot gets lost, you know, in terms of research and where things are and where things aren't.
So now you finally have a bit of a map in terms of what's on these tapes. I assume it wasn't 100% complete, but at least it gets you further than listening to tape at a time.
Oh, yeah.
Having various conversations.
Yeah, it was 90% there, you know.
Now, I understand that you also have the Francis Wolfe negatives. How did those come into your possession?
Well, when Charlie Laurie and I started Blue Note, started Mosaic Records, in 1982, Alfred Lion had only been in touch with Horace Silver since he retired. And because his wife didn't want him to get near the record business because it had so stressed him out and he had a nervous condition and so on and so forth. So Horace was the only conduit between him and the rest of the world. And I used to ask Horace questions to ask Alfred. And he was curious about me and what I was about and so forth. So he read a review in the New York Times of our first Mosaic release, which included the Blue Note Thelonious Monk sessions and the Blue Note Albert Ammons Mean Lux Lewis sessions. So he was so afraid of his wife at the time that he went to a neighbor's house and called the Mosaic number collect. And just as Charlie and I were walking in the door of his apartment, which was our office and warehouse at the time, and Charlie looked like someone had told him his family had been axe murdered, and he handed me the phone. He said, "It's a collect call from Alfred Lion for you." So that opened up an endless dialogue, and we became friends and spent a lot of time together. And, you know, his wife, Ruth, got on board with it, the fact that he couldn't stay away from his legacy. As time went on, I learned that that Francis had given him his entire photo archive and that it was all in trunks. And, you know, Alfred didn't want to get sad about the old days, so he didn't even look in there. But Ruth was willing to. So, you know, we started to ask them about photos for Mosaic boxes where there were no photos available, like Herbie Nichols, you know, and early Bud Powell and stuff. So she started digging into the archives, and Alfred got involved. And, you know, eventually we were just buying rights to photographs, from them. And, you know, eventually it got to the point where they said, "Would you like to, you know, curate and take care of this collection?" And we did, and eventually, and Alfred passed away, and we eventually bought it from Ruth. And then my wife, who's an artist and a photographer, started archiving it, which took about a year and a half because it was all in a disarray.
Same condition like the audio tapes that you found.
Well, you know, they were in a disarray in the sense that they were, all the negative strips were in glassine envelopes, and they were with contact sheets, and they were stuffed into manila envelopes with the names and dates and scribbled on. And what you had to do was take it all out, put it into, you know, archival plastic sheets, and develop a database system to find stuff. And it was a long process. But, you know, then we started with, mining that catalog, not just for Mosaic and Blue Note releases, but selling prints. And we published a book in 1995 with Rizzoli. And, you know, and we've done about 5 books ever since then. But that was the beginning of the whole thing. And it was pretty unbelievable because, you know, when you go into the vault with an artist, you know, you expect to maybe, if you're lucky, to find 6 gems and 7 okay performances that are worthy of release. But here we had 20,000 images, 99.8% of which had never been seen by anybody. And so it was an embarrassment of riches that we've been slogging through, that we're still slogging through to this day. My wife and I were just going through Hank Mobley's sessions last weekend and picking great shots that we had never noticed before. So it's, you know, it's endless.
Now, it sounds like you understood the historical significance of this fairly early on. Did Alfred Lion, did his family, did his friends understand kind of the place that Blue Note held and would hold in the future?
I don't think so. Alfred was kind of surprised by all that, when Blue Note material would be reissued in the 70s or 80s. I mean, he was kind of surprised by the great reception that it received, you know, in the press. And and when I took him to Japan I produced the Mount Fuji Blue Note Jazz Festival there, and it was all Blue Note centric, you know, like I had a quintet with like Cedar Walton and Billy Higgins and Buster Williams and Woody Shaw and Jackie McLean doing, you know, Sonny Clark minor blues tunes. Because the Japanese love minor blues. It's very much akin to their, you know, their own indigenous music. And when they played the first 2 notes of Cool Strutting, the whole audience, 15,000 people, just erupted, you know, like it was, like they were, you know, like they were doing some Santana tune or Stairway to Heaven, you know. It was just unbelievable. And I mean, I remember Alfred looking at me like, what, you know? And then when I introduced Alfred on the stage, he got like a standing ovation, and he had no idea how Blue Note was regarded and how much it meant to so many people around the world. So, you know, his last couple of years were great because we were able to plug him into seeing the impact that he had on the world.
Yeah. 'Cause he came from a time when music was fairly disposable. They'd release it, it would last a couple of weeks, and then, you know, it would just kind of disappear.
Yeah, till the next 78, right.
Yeah. Okay. Also in the archive, again, using the term there, the pile of stuff you're going through, Jimmy Reed designs, mock-ups, lettering, tools of a typesetter's trade. When you worked with Blue Note, what was the condition of those items? Did Blue Note tend to hang on to them and file them, or was it like a bunch of hoarders just stuffing things into drawers?
I think they tended to hang on to them, but I can't prove it, and I never thought to ask Alfred. But you see, Blue Note moved 3 times in its life, and then when it was sold to Liberty Records, it moved again to another New York building, and then eventually it all moved out to LA. Now, in the process, most of the tapes survived, issued and unissued. And but most of the A&R files didn't. Hence, I had to find out from Japan what Alfred's file was. But the things like mechanicals, and in those days, mechanicals were done on you know, like 10-inch by 20-inch boards. Everything was pasted up on boards. Those were very bulky and very heavy, and I don't know if they saved them at the time, but I do know that they do no longer exist. What did exist was when Bruce Lundvall restarted Blue Note in 1984 and I came aboard, what did exist at that time was the film separations for each of the covers, which were like, you know, about 15 by 15 images on film and layered. You know, there'd be a type layer and a photo layer and a design layer and a background color layer. And I ordered a few of those where the Blue Note record was in a catalog or advertised on an inner sleeve, but it never came out for real. So I ordered all those so I could recreate those covers for the unissued material. But, and so that a couple of those things sat in my office for a couple of years. And then at one point we wanted to get more separations of the issued material. And at that point we found out that Queens Litho in the interim had gone out of business and that everything in their Midwest warehouse was scrapped. So, you know, again, another chunk of history, you know, in dumpsters. You know.
Okay. Now, in the mid-70s, there was these two disc releases, I believe, which Charlie Lorre led, the Blue Note reissue series.
Right.
What was involved in those compilations? Were they just, you know, pulling tapes and clumping them together? Or well, how much care was put into those?
Well, I think a lot of care was put into it. Initially, it was... they had these multicolored covers, and Duke Pearson was doing them. And I know he put a lot of care into them because he was, you know, a producer and arranger, and he was at a lot of the sessions. And I know, like, the 2LP collection he did on Stanley Turrentine, he actually went into the vaults and pulled some unissued material and used it on that collection. Then what happened was that Duke had gotten sick, and he had moved back to Atlanta. At that time, that's when I met Charlie, and I showed him all this unissued material that was sitting there. So when I had, you know, put together about 10 or 15 double albums of material, he said, "We got to keep the Blue Note reissue series title because it's already established." And I said, "But this is not reissues, it's unissued material." And we went back and forth, and he won. So we called it but they came out in these tan covers. And that was the beginning of my mining the Blue Note vaults for unissued material.
Was Rudy Van Gelder involved in any of these activities?
No. At that point, Rudy, in the two-thirds of the 70s, Rudy was exclusively hired by CTI Records. He wasn't taking any other clients. He was block-booked by Creed Taylor. And then around 1977 or so, his first wife passed away, and he was fairly devastated. And he closed his studio for like 2 years. And then he opened it back up around 1979 or 80. And at that point, I put together a Blue Note 40th anniversary set for Blue Note in Europe. And I did that with Rudy. That was kind of his first reentry into the, you know, looking back at the Blue Note stuff he had done. You know, and then as the years went on, we started to do more. We later did the Rudy Van Gelder series, where he got to remaster tons of Blue Note records that he had made, you know.
When you think about the material in the Blue Note vaults, what's the volume that you reckon is released versus not released? I mean, 90% released, 70% released? How much material is in there that hasn't seen the light of day yet?
Oh, very little. Yeah, it's 95% released. The only things that are unreleased, there's, you know, some very ill-advised sessions that were just a train wreck. There was a Tyrone Washington session that was a complete mess. There was Herbie Hancock that tried to do an R&B kind of funk record in '66 And that was, that just didn't work. It was before he really understood what all that music was about. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a mess. And Herbie will be the first to tell you, for his Blue Note, complete Blue Note Herbie Hancock 6 CD set that we put out on Blue Note, he, just for curiosity's sake, he let me put out one track, but that was it. You know, there was a Kenny Durham session that was kind of a funky kind of thing around 61, but Kenny's trumpet chops were so bad throughout the whole thing that it was just unreleasable. And there was an Art Blakey session that was just like a funeral parlor. It was just nothing caught fire. Even, you know, with Art Blakey on drums, that's hard. But nothing caught fire. So there are things that are just bad that aren't going to come out. But the only good stuff that we hadn't dealt with is that there's still a lot of maybe two or three albums worth of the three sounds that haven't been released, but there's not that much of a demand for them. So, you know, I just never got around to finding an excuse to put those out. Mm. But that's pretty much it. I mean, from 1975 to now, and I don't know how many years that is, but I have managed to get out everything that I wanted to get out.
Yeah, because you got involved in a lot of sessions that were recorded, you know, in the 60s, but weren't released until the Blue Note Classic series, stuff like Wayne Shorter, etc., Art Blakey, Africaine. God, yeah. But curiously, they weren't given like a Blue Note treatment with the covers and the pictures and that sort of thing. They almost look like classical music albums or stock photography, more so than they do jazz records. What was the thinking behind that trend at the time?
Well, you're talking about the covers that were mainly white.
Yeah,
with a photo in the middle.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was at a... after the double album series died, I kept trying to get United Artists, which owned Blue Note at the time, to revive this and get more of this unissued material out. And they finally agreed in 1979. And there was a young A&R guy there named Gary Gersh, who later ended up being the president of Capitol Records. But his idea, he said, well, you know, right now ECM is the most popular jazz record label in the industry, and why don't we try to do covers that kind of look like that? And, you know, I was at a point where I had won, you know, 8 of my 10 points, and I just said, to get this through, I'll let this go, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we did those covers, which I thought were not misguided, but they missed the mark in terms of what the music was. They weren't, if they had looked more like Blue Note covers, they probably would have done better. As it was, you know, I put out, I don't know, about 20 or mm-hmm. 30 of them over a period of a year and a half, but they didn't do that well. You know, and the jazz press wasn't really wired into those things at the time. I mean, in 1978, I went into the Blue Note, the Impulse vaults, and I was putting out unissued Coltrane, and nobody gave a shit. I was amazed that nobody cared about this stuff. And, you know, it was a hard time for the record business, and I think a splintered time for jazz, which was, you know, going through a lot of fusion and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. But nobody really cared about that stuff. I found it very discouraging, especially Coltrane. My God, I mean, he was my God, you know?
It was certainly the dark ages of the jazz record business during that time.
Yeah.
But, hey, you know, if it wasn't for pockets of the stuff you're doing with Blue Note or some of the issues, there were some Japanese-only issues. I think Blue Mitchell, Step Lightly, and a handful of others
right.
as well. So thank God for those pockets of resistance there.
Yeah.
Does listening to hours and hours of music get exhausting? I mean, especially outtakes?
Yeah, oh, yeah, very much. You know, and I mean, the only way to do it is to juggle it. You know, if you're listening to Sonny Clark trio material, then you go to something like Blue Mitchell Quintet, and then if after you're burned out on that, you go to something like Wayne Shorter that's a little more exploratory. I mean, you have to balance your stuff. It's interesting that, you know, when you do mosaic sets, which are, mm-hmm. you know, 4, 5, 6, 8 CDs, sometimes even bigger, that the only artist that I ever did box sets on and wasn't burned out on that artist for 2 months was Nat Cole and Count Basie. Yeah. Everybody else, I just couldn't listen to their music for at least 2 or 3 months to, you know, to regroup, you know. Yeah, it is very tedious.
So let's talk about Mosaic. So I'm not sure what year it was founded, but you got the idea for putting together these box sets. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we started technically in 82, but we didn't get to release anything till 83. Basically, Charlie had gone from Blue Note to Warner Brothers Jazz Department, and then was, in true record business style, was let go on a downsizing thing on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving in 81. So we'd always wanted to work together, and so we developed a plan for revitalizing Blue Note with Capitol Records, and who had, by this time, Capitol EMI had taken over possession of Blue Note, Pacific Jazz, Liberty, UA, all those labels. And so we made like a, you know, a 10-page presentation about signing new artists and, you know, developing catalog releases. And way in the back, I put one little paragraph about box sets, mainly because both Charlie and I had been big fans of those Columbia box sets that came out in the in the 60s. You know, there was Jack Tegar and a Billie Holiday, 52nd Street. There was a Fletcher Henderson. There was a bunch of them. And they were so cool with great booklets and stuff. So anyway, so I put that in. And the main reason that I put it in was because during about a year and a half of unemployment, I was living in L.A. with a girlfriend, and I used to go to the Unite Artists Vault every day, and I'd listen and start cataloging all of the Blue Note tapes. And I got so far along that I'd finished the tapes, and I said, well, I guess I should go back and listen to the lacquers from the 40s. And I started listening to those, and I found a bunch of Thelonious Monk alternate takes and a couple of unissued tunes that were great, but it was only like 28 minutes of music. I said, that'll never be an LP. I can never sell anyone on putting out 28 minutes as an LP. And so it occurred to me one day, God, if I ever get the chance, what would I do? And then I realized, well, what I should do, because the Monk material at Blue Note in particular, once the LP era came in, that stuff got jumbled up the way it was released on LP, because it was all 78 sessions. So there was a Monk Volume 1 and Volume 2 that had parts of all the sessions scrambled up, you know, one session going to another. And then there was half an LP's worth of Monk material on a Milt Jackson record, and there were a few things that were only on 78. And I said, well, you know, maybe, I mean, the thing to do is to really give this material its due and, you know, retransfer it all and put it out in chronological order. And then I can get my 28 minutes woven in with the rest of this stuff. And so that's how I got fixated on the box set idea. And that became the bedrock of Mosaic Records, because, you know, in the early 80s, the record companies were not interested in jazz.
Yeah, so you were able to parlay your connections, not only at Blue Note, but also Impulse, Columbia, all the other, you know, labels, significant jazz labels, to be able to pull that material from all those different sources for the Mosaic releases, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, because they weren't really interested in any of that material at the time. I mean, they were, you know, interested in, you know, breaking the next pop act, or in, you know, maximizing, you know, Bruce Springsteen's catalog. You know, the last thing they were going to worry about is Thelonious Monk or Jerry Mulligan or anybody like that. It was a rough time in the record business, and it would stay a rough time in the record business until the CD came along.
Were there any particular labels or recordings that were difficult to get? Or were they all pretty open to your suggestions?
No, most of them were open, but there were difficult ones. Like Columbia would not give me Miles Davis. Mm-hmm. And I understand why. If I were them, I wouldn't have given me that either. You know, and then later, when they wanted to organize the Miles Davis vault in a mosaic style of releases, somebody said, hey, well, why don't we just call Michael Gascon and have him do it? So I did, and I said, all right, in exchange for that, you don't want the LP rights. Can I do the LP rights for each of these boxes? And so that's what I did. I put out, CD sets on Columbia Legacy, and I put out the LP counterpart on Mosaic.
Oh, okay, that's how that worked. Now, right now, is Mosaic primarily CD based, or
it is.
Okay.
Yeah, we tried a new line of vinyl, because vinyl really for us, you know, by the end of the 90s. It was winding down to almost nothing. And I knew that part of the reason for that was the problem of making a counterpart LP set for a Mosaic CD set. Because if a Mosaic CD set is 7 CDs, you know, that's going to be 10 or 11 LPs. And that gets unwieldy, and it gets expensive. Yeah. And even though we were doing 180-gram audiophile vinyl, and we were only charging $17 per LP at that time, where most labels were charging $30 per LP, but still 17 times 11 is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So we had to phase out LPs with the regular Mosaic line, because it would have put us out of business. But then I thought, well, maybe I'll create an LP line that, you know, is its own separate line. And if I keep it to 3 to 5 LPs, that will be a reasonably priced and, you know, containable set to do. Mm-hmm. And we did about 7 or 8 sets, you know, the Thelonious Monk completed, Club Recordings, the complete Clifford Brown, Max Roach, Studio Recordings, and a few others, you know, about 8 in all. This is in the 2000s into the early 2010s, and they really didn't do much for us. So I had to abandon it, because unfortunately, you know, you can't, you can be happy putting out 700 sets of a limited edition of something, but the fact is you have to sign contracts with the record companies guaranteeing them that you guarantee to buy 1,500 units. Well, you know, if you only sell 700 and you owe them for 800 more units, even if you don't manufacture them, those kind of bills can put you out of business very quickly.
Yeah. How do you decide what gets the Mosaic treatment? I mean, do you start with a theme? Do you have a wish list that you're still working on? How do you decide what's next?
Yeah, well, the wish list ran out mm-hmm. a few years ago. But it was amazing. It existed long enough that there was stuff that we weren't putting out till 20 years after we started, you know. But basically, it's just what occurs to us, or what Mosaic buyers suggest to us. And then we research it, and then, you know, two things have to happen. It has to be, a certain amount of it has to be off the market. We hope to find unissued material. And then, secondly, it has to be with a label that's willing to license it to us. So, there's a lot that you have to go through just to consider a set. Then, of course, if you do, and you get the green light, then there's a whole other set of research and, audio problems that you have to go through.
How many times have you been in the final stages of a box set when new material becomes available?
Thankfully, never.
Okay.
The Complete Pacific Jazz Chico Hamilton, where somehow in cutting and pasting, I left off one tune on from the list that we submitted for licensing. And I had to go through hell to, look, I'll pay an extra dollar per set, but let me just put it on there, you know. I can't go not complete. And that created a lot of problems. But no, there are things that and I can't think of any examples right now, but there are things where you put it out and you have all the information you think you can possibly have in terms of recording dates and personnel and so on. And the minute it comes out, two mavens from, you know, Upper Slavovia or Southern Japan could come out of the woodwork with information that you would have killed for, you know, when you were putting the set together. So there's a lot of little errata that comes up when every set comes out, because there's always somebody more deeply into that particular artist than you are. So there are details that come to light that we don't get into our booklets, and that frustrates me no end. But I don't think we've ever missed a master.
What's the most rewarding Mosaic releases that you've been involved in?
Well, two come to mind for one reason. The Tina Brooks set and the Herbie Nichols set come to mind because I learned early on in this game that a reissue of an album will only do relatively as well as it did as a new album. So if you reissue Lee Morgan, The Sidewinder, it will do very well. It won't do as well as it originally did, but it'll do very well. And if you put out Lee Morgan, Carumba, which nobody seemed to notice, it won't do well. It won't sell well. So the idea that with reissues you could rewrite history is really not true for the most part. But with Tina Brooks and Herbie Nichols, it was true. They got such press and they got such recognition that that Tina Brooks, who almost nobody knew about, and Herbie Nichols, who, you know, only a few dedicated fans knew about, they're like now in the history books. And it was as a result of those sets. And I'm particularly happy with Herbie Nichols because then people started recording his tunes and there was a whole big renaissance in Herbie Nichols. Mm. And that was very gratifying, you know, to kind of be able to affect the past and rewrite history and get somebody their due. It doesn't happen often, but it did in those two cases. And so that was great. And you know, the other ones I'm most proud of, I guess, is the Nat Cole box, which took forever because it was 18 CDs and just, you know, one of my favorite groups of all, the Nat Cole Trio. And the Count Basie, the Roulette Count Basie Big Band, I did a live set and I did a studio set. And they're both, I guess the live set for me is my favorite because I just, you know, I'm just a Sonny Payne fan. He just was so extraordinary, the way he could drive a band. And that band was the hippest, coolest band in the world.
So some of these Mosaic box sets now go for hundreds of dollars, a couple of them even into the thousands. How do you feel when you see some of these sets that are just going crazy on the price? Does that sit well with you? What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, it does. Because one of the reasons... when we first started Mosaic, and, you know, people were, you know, at that point used to buying single LPs. I mean, one of the inducements we thought was, and one of the reasons we made them limited editions and hand numbered, was that they would have value going forward. Mm. And that people would, they would never drop in value if you treated them well, but they could possibly go up in value.
That was a desired outcome. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We thought we were giving something people that was not just joy, but an investment. Mm-hmm. So I'm thrilled at that. I'm glad that it all worked out that way. You know?
Excellent. In working with Mosaic, there's some really interesting releases. I'd love to hear the stories behind them, some anecdotes. In particular, two releases come to mind, the Monk Coltrane at Carnegie and the Dean Benedetti tapes. Can you share with us how those came to be?
Yeah. Well, the Monk Coltrane was Lewis Porter, who wrote an excellent book on Coltrane, and he's a professor and a pianist and has written a lot. He called me one day and said that, he'd found in the Amsterdam News an ad for a Carnegie Hall concert with Monk and with Coltrane and with Ray Charles and Billie Holiday and I guess Chet Baker and Zoot Sims, I think, and a couple other acts. And he said, have you ever heard of this? And I said, no way. I have no idea. And so he called everybody he knew and people he didn't know, put the word out. And so apparently the Voice of America broadcast the concert or taped it for broadcast, but never did broadcast it.
Oh, okay.
And so Larry Applebaum.
What year was this, by the way?
That all this discovery came about?
Yeah, no, the year of the concert of the show.
Oh, the concert, it was November of 57.
All right, and the Amsterdam News, that's a newspaper from New York, a local community newspaper, so it wasn't like a large publication. It was a very curious
thing. No, it was a Harlem newspaper, basically black press.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so finally, a couple of years later, Larry Applebaum calls me and says, I think I found it. And I said, you found what? He says, the Monk Coltrane at Carnegie Hall. And so and he called Lewis, and I said, Larry, how can I get to hear this thing? What do you want me to do? He said, well, they're not going to let me copy it, and the only way for you to hear it would be for me to get on a train, and with the tape, they'll let me, because I'm an employee of the Library of Congress engineering staff, they'll let me travel with it. So I said, all right, so let's come on up. So he came up, and T.S. Monk and I met him at this mastering studio where we could make a high-res digital file of it. Mm-hmm. And it was some fucking believable because, I mean, there's nothing of that band except a couple of studio recordings when they first got together in July, but this is November. They were playing together 5 months every night of the week, and it was just exceptional and extraordinary. And for me, and for Toot Monk, we were both so amazed to really finally hear Shadow Wilson as in a context where he's as great as all the old drummers used to talk about him being.
Mm-hmm.
But, so this is a major find. I mean, it was, a missing link in the history of jazz. And so we were making a high-res transfer with the idea of cutting a deal with Blue Note. And so they all went out to lunch, and I said, I'm going to just stay behind with the engineer and I'm going to cut a lacquer on this thing. So I cut a lacquer on it from the original tapes because the original tapes are going to go away that night and be forever gone. So I cut a lacquer so that I could put out an LP and worked out a deal with the Monk Estate and with Blue Note and was able to put out the LP version of that. So that was
wow.
That was a great find all the way around.
You didn't know it existed, and then you were able to find a professional recording of it.
Beautifully recorded. Yeah, amazing.
Wow.
So, never say never, I guess, is what you learn from that. And I suppose the Benedetti thing is another example of that. People talk about the legendary Larry Young, John Coltrane tapes that when Larry went to Coltrane's house in Dix Hills, Long Island, that they got together and they jammed and just duet and Larry even told me that and that the tape was rolling, but does that tape still exist? I highly doubt it, but of course I highly doubted it when the whole Dean Benedetti legend was circulating. And then one night after the Grammy Awards,
just to bring people up to speed here on Dean Benedetti.
Oh, okay.
He correct me if I go off the story here. He was a fan of Charlie Parker. He was on the West Coast, I believe, and Charlie Parker was.
No, he was on the East Coast.
Oh, he's on the East Coast. Okay.
And Dean Benedetti went to see Charlie Parker several nights, and he bought a little record recorder. And it wasn't the records that, you know, we think of, the hard ones.
It was a disc cutter.
Paper records. And so he recorded hundreds of Charlie Parker solos, but then just stuffed all these records into a suitcase. And there was a bit of a legend around these recordings. They kind of had their own life and hype before they were actually discovered. How were they discovered?
Well, they lived in hype when Ross Russell wrote a book on Charlie Parker. Mm. And he painted Dean Benedetti as this weirdo, kind of drugged out amateur musician who was, you know, recording Bird on a disc cutter and clubs. Mm. And actually, Dean Benedetti was a very serious musician and composer and was obsessed with Charlie Parker and asked his permission. He got his permission every time to record him because you couldn't be discreet in those days. You had a big disc cutter sitting on a table. So these all went into boxes. And Dean Benedetti went to, in the early 50s, went to back to Italy, and then he passed away there. And the stuff sat in his brother Rick's basement until one of the nights of the Grammys in the 90s, when Bob Porter won a Grammy for the Savoy Charlie Parker box that he had produced. And after the broadcast, in the middle of the night, Bob said his phone rang. He woke him up, and he said, "Hi, I'm Rick Benedetti. I don't know if you know my brother Dean, but he recorded Charlie Parker, and I heard you just won the Grammy for Charlie Parker recordings, and you might be interested in this." So Bob woke up in a flash and said, "Oh my God, I can't believe this shit exists, and it's falling in my lap, you know." Mm-hmm. And so Bob went to a couple of major labels, including Arista, which was putting out the Savoy Charlie Parker, and nobody seemed interested. And then Clint Eastwood started to work on the
Bird.
On the Bird album, Bird film. And so Bruce Ricker set up a meeting with Clint and Bob and the discs. And Clint wasn't interested. It just didn't suit what his needs were for the film in any way, shape, or form. So Bob was telling me one day, it's just, I can't believe it, but nobody's interested in this stuff. So I said, "Well, how about we do it?" You know, he said, "Sure." You know, so we cut a deal with Bob, and then Charlie went out and flew out to L.A. and talked to Rick Benedetti and made a deal. We brought the tapes back here. We realized it was mind-boggling, and so I hired Phil Schaap to do the unraveling and the transfers and to, mm-hmm. you know, put it into releasable form.
Wow, that must have been very difficult for the transfers, because those paper discs, but you can only play them a couple of times.
They weren't paper discs. They were acetate discs. Mm. But then he went to paper tape, which only existed for a very short time. And then he went to regular audio tape. But it presented its problems because it was all in terrible condition, you know. And only a mind like Phil Schaap's could have really put this whole thing together the way it needed to be put together.
Well, we're very glad that they ended up in your lap there, and the work that you've done at Mosaic is phenomenal. And Michael, I think I could probably talk to you for hours and hours and just keep getting this great information coming out. But again, you know, we both have to end this conversation at some point and go eat. So let me let you go for now. I'd love to have you back on the show at some point. I'd like to ask the audience to check out mosaicrecords.com. There are many box sets out there. It's hundreds.
Yeah, but there's only about 30 that are in print at this particular time because everything is a limited edition.
Sure, sure. But there are hundreds out there on the market, on the secondary market. But now, if you go to mosaicrecords.com, there's a Mingus set, the Jazz Workshop concerts. There's Teddy Wilson, Lester Young. So check out mosaicrecords.com. And again, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an honor.
Thank you.